Chapter 6 Death in the Big City. Dodie Eberhardt was pissed off. And when Dodie Eberhardt was pissed off, there was one broad in the nation's capital you didn't want to fuck with. She climbed the stairs of the L Street apartment building with the stolidity, and nearly the bulk, of a rhino crossing an open stretch of grassland. Her navy blue dress stretched and relaxed over a bosom which was rather too large to simply be called ample. Her meaty arms swung like pendulums. A good many years ago, this woman had been one of Washington's most stunning call girls. In those days, her height, 6'3", as well as her good looks, had made her more than just a naughty bit of fluff. She was so sought after that a night with her was almost as good as a trophy in a sporting gentleman's den. And if one were to carefully review the photographs of various Washington fetes and soirees taken during the second Johnson administration and the first Nixon administration, one might spot Dodie Eberhardt in many of them, usually on the arm of a man whose name appeared frequently in weighty political articles and essays. Her height alone made her hard to miss. Dodie was a whore with the heart of a bank teller and the soul of an acquisitive cockroach. Two of her regular Johns, one a Democratic senator and the other a Republican representative with a good deal of seniority, had provided her with enough cash to retire from the business. They had not exactly done this of their own volition. Dodie was aware that the risk of disease was not exactly decreasing, and highly placed government officials are as vulnerable to AIDS and various lesser but still troubling venereal diseases as the commoners. Her age wasn't decreasing either. Nor did she completely trust these gentlemen to leave her something in their wills, as both had promised to do. "I'm sorry," she told them, "but I don't believe in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy anymore either, you see. Little Dodie is all on her own." Little Dodie purchased 3 apartment houses with the money. Years passed. The £170 which had brought strong men to their knees, usually in front of her as she stood nude before them, had now become 280. Investments which had done well in the mid-70s had soured in the '80s, when it seemed everyone else in the country with money in the stock market was getting well. She'd had 2 excellent brokers on her short list right up until the end of the active phase of her career. There were times she wished she'd held on to them when she retired. One apartment house had gone in 84, the second in 86, following a disastrous IRS audit. She had held on to this one on L Street as grimly as a losing player in a cutthroat game of Monopoly, convinced that it was in a neighborhood which was about to happen. But it hadn't happened yet, and she didn't think it would happen for another year or two, if then. When it did, she meant to pack her bags and move to Aruba. In the meantime, the landlady who had once been the capital city's most sought-after fuck would just have to hang on. Which she always had. Which she intended to keep on doing. And God help anyone who got in her way. Like Frederick Mr. Big Shot Clawson, for instance. She reached the second floor landing. Guns N' Roses was bellowing out of the Shulman's apartment.
"Turn that fucking record player down," she yelled at the top of her lungs.
And when Dodie Eberhardt raised her voice to its maximum decibel level, windows cracked, the eardrums of small children ruptured, and dogs fell dead. The music went from a scream to a whisper at once. She could sense the Shulmans quivering against each other like a pair of scared puppies in a thunderstorm, and praying it was not them the Wicked Witch of L Street had come to see. They were afraid of her. That was not an unwise way to feel. Shulman was a corporate lawyer with a high-powered firm, but he was still 2 ulcers away from being high-powered enough to give Dodie pause. If he should cross her at this stage of his young life, she would wear his guts for garters, and he knew it, and that was very satisfactory. When the bottom dropped out of both your bank accounts and your investment portfolio, you had to take your satisfactions where you found them. Dodie turned the corner without breaking stride and started up the stairs to the 3rd floor, where Frederick Mr. Big Shot Clawson lived in solitary splendor. She walked with that same even rhino crossing the veldt stride, head up, not in the least out of breath in spite of her poundage, the staircase shaking the tiniest bit in spite of its solidity. She was looking forward to this. Clawson wasn't even on a low rung of a corporate law ladder. As of now, He wasn't on the ladder at all. Like all the law students she had ever met, mostly as tenants, she had certainly never fucked any in what she now thought of as her other life. He was composed chiefly of high aspirations and low funds, both of them floating on a generous cushion of bullshit. Doty did not, as a rule, confuse any of these elements. Falling for a law student's line of bull was, in her mind, as bad as turning a trick for free. Once you started in with behavior like that, you might as well hang up your jock. Figuratively speaking, of course. Yet Frederick Mr. Big Shot Clausen had partially breached her defenses. He had been late with the rent 4 times in a row, and she had allowed this because he had convinced her that, in his case, the tired old scripture was really the truth, or might come to be. He did have money coming in. He could not have done this to her if he had claimed Sidney Sheldon was really Robert Ludlum, or Victoria Holt was really Rosemary Rogers, because she didn't give a shit about those people or their billions of write-alikes. She was into crime novels, and if they were real gut-bucket crime novels, so much the better. She supposed there were plenty of people out there who went for the romantic slop and the spy shit, if the post-Sunday bestseller list was any indication. But she had been reading Elmore Leonard for years before he hit the lists, and she had also formed strong attachments for Jim Thompson, David Goodis, Horace McCoy, Charles Williford, and the rest of those guys. If you wanted it short and sweet, Doty Eberhardt liked novels where men robbed banks, shot each other, and demonstrated how much they loved their women mostly by beating the shit out of them. George Stark, in her opinion, was, or had been, the best of them. She had been a dedicated fan from Machine's Way and Oxford Blues right up to Riding to Babylon, which looked to be the last of them. The big shot in the third-floor apartment had been surrounded by notes and Stark novels the first time she came to dun him about the rent. Only 3 days overdue that time, but of course if he gave them an inch, they took a mile. And after she had taken care of her business and he had promised to deliver a check to her by noon the following day, she asked him if the collected works of George Stark were now required reading for a career before the bar. No, Clausen had said, with a bright, cheerful, and utterly predatory smile. But they might just finance one. It was the smile more than anything else which had hooked her and caused her to pay out line in his case where she had snubbed it brutally tight in all others. She had seen that smile many times before in her own mirror. She had believed then that such a smile could not be faked, and, just for the record, she still believed it. Clausen really had had the goods on Thaddeus Beaumont. His mistake had been believing so confidently that Beaumont would go along with the plans of a Mr. Big Shot like Frederick Clausen. And it had been her mistake, too. She had read one of the two Beaumont novels, Purple Haze, following Clausen's explanation of what he had discovered, and thought it an exquisitely stupid book. In spite of the correspondence and photocopies Mr. Big Shot had shown her, she would have found it difficult or impossible to believe both writers were the same man. Except, about 3/4 of the way through it, at a point where she had been about ready to throw the boring piece of shit across the room and forget the whole thing, there was a scene in which a farmer shot a horse. The horse had 2 broken legs and needed to be shot, but the thing was, old Farmer John had enjoyed it. Had, in fact, put the barrel of the gun against the horse's head and then jerked himself off, squeezing the trigger at the moment of climax. It was, she thought, as if Beaumont had stepped out to get a cup of coffee when he got to that part, and George Stark had stepped in and written the scene, like a literary Rumpelstiltskin. Certainly it was the only gold in that particular pile of hay. Well, none of it mattered now. All it proved was that no one was immune to bullshit forever. The big shot had taken her for a ride, but at least it had been a short ride, and it was now over. Doty Eberhardt reached the third floor landing, her hand already curling into the sort of tight fist she made when the time had come not for polite knocking but hammering. And then she saw hammering would not be necessary. The big shot's door was standing ajar. Jesus wept. Doty muttered, her lip curling. This wasn't a junkie neighborhood, but when it came to ripping off some idiot's apartment, the junkies were more than willing to cross boundary lines. The guy was even stupider than she had thought. She rapped on the door with her knuckles, and it swung open. Clausen, she called in a voice which promised doom and damnation. There was no answer. Looking up the short corridor, she could see the shades in the living room were drawn and the overhead light was burning. A radio was playing softly.
Clausen, I want to talk to you.
She started up the short corridor and stopped. One of the sofa cushions was on the floor. That was all. No sign that the place had been trashed by a hungry junkie, but her instincts were still sharp, and her wind was up in a moment. She smelled something. It was very faint, but it was there, a little like food which had spoiled but not yet rotted. That wasn't it, but it was as close as she could come. Had she smelled it before? She thought she had. And there was another smell, although she didn't think it was her nose which was making her aware of it. She knew that one right away. She and Trooper Hamilton from Connecticut would have agreed at once on what it was. The smell of bad. She stood just outside the living room, looking at the tumbled cushion, listening to the radio. What the climb up three flights of stairs hadn't been able to do, that one innocent cushion had. Her heart was beating rapidly under her massive left breast, and her breath was coming shallowly through her mouth. Something was not right here. Very much not right. The question was whether or not she would become a part of it if she hung around. Common sense told her to go. Go while she still had a chance, and common sense was very strong. Curiosity told her to stay and peek, and it was stronger. She edged her head around the entrance to the living room and looked first to her right, where there was a fake fireplace, two windows giving a view on L Street and not much else. She looked to the left, and her head suddenly stopped moving. It actually seemed to lock in position. Her eyes widened. That locked stare lasted no more than 3 seconds, but it seemed much longer to her. And she saw everything, down to the smallest detail. Her mind made its own photograph of what it was seeing, as clear and sharp as those the crime photographer would soon take. She saw the two bottles of Amstel beer on the coffee table, one empty and the other half full, with a collar of foam still inside the bottleneck. She saw the ashtray with Chicagoland written on its curving surface. She saw two cigarette butts, unfiltered, squashed into the center of the tray's pristine whiteness, although the big shot didn't smoke. Not cigarettes, at least. She saw the small plastic box, which had once been full of pushpins, lying on its side between the bottles and the ashtray. Most of the pushpins, which the big shot used to tack things to his kitchen bulletin board, were scattered across the glass surface of the coffee table. She saw a few had come to rest on an open copy of People magazine, the one featuring the Thad Beaumont-George Stark story. She could see Mr. and Mrs. Beaumont shaking hands across Stark's gravestone, although from here they were upside down. It was the story that, according to Frederick Clausen, would never be printed. It was going to make him a moderately wealthy man instead. He had been wrong about that. In fact, it seemed he had been wrong about everything. She could see Frederick Clausen, who had gone from Mr. Big Shot to no shot at all, sitting in one of his two living room chairs. He had been tied in. He was naked, his clothes thrown into a snarly ball under the coffee table. She saw the bloody hole at his groin. His testicles were still where they belonged. His penis had been stuffed into his mouth. There was plenty of room, because the murderer had also cut out Mr. Big Shot's tongue. It was tacked to the wall. The pushpin had been driven into its pink meat so deeply that she could only see a grinning crescent of bright yellow, which was the pushpin's top, and her mind relentlessly photographed this, too. Blood had drizzled down the wallpaper below it, making a wavery fan shape. The killer had employed another pushpin, this one with a bright green head, to nail the second page of the People magazine article to the ex-Big Shot's bare chest. She could not see Liz Beaumont's face, it was obscured by Clausen's blood, but she could see the woman's hand, holding out the pan of brownies for Thad's smiling inspection. She remembered that picture in particular had irked Clausen. "What a put-up job," he had exclaimed. "She hates to cook. She said so in an interview just after Beaumont published his first novel." Finger written in blood above the severed tongue tacked to the wall were these five words. "The sparrows are flying again." Jesus Christ, some distant part of her mind thought. It's just like a George Stark novel, like something Alexis Machine would do. From behind her came a soft bumping sound. Dodie Eberhardt screamed and whirled. Machine came at her with his terrible straight razor, its steely glitter now sleeved with Frederick Clausen's blood. His face was the twisted mask of scars which was all Noni Griffiths had left after she carved him up at the end of Machine's way, and there was no one there at all. The door had swung shut, that was all, the way doors sometimes do. "Is that so?" the distant part of her mind asked. Except it was closer now, raising its voice, urgent with fright. "It was standing partway open with no problem at all when you came up the stairs. Not wide open, but enough so you could tell it wasn't shut." Now her eyes went back to the beer bottles on the coffee table. One empty, one half full with a ring of foam still on the inside of the neck. The killer had been behind the door when she came in. If she had turned her head, she would almost surely have seen him. And now she would be dead too. And while she had been standing here, mesmerized by the colorful remains of Frederick Mr. Big Shot Clausen, he had simply gone out, closing the door behind him. The strength flowed out of her legs and she slipped to her knees with a weird kind of grace, looking like a girl about to take communion. Her mind ran frantically over the same thought, like a gerbil on an exercise wheel. "Oh, I shouldn't have screamed. He'll come back. Oh, I shouldn't have screamed. He'll come back. Oh, I shouldn't have screamed." And then she heard him, the measured thud of his big feet on the hall carpet. Later she became convinced that the goddamn Schulmans had turned up their stereo again, and she had mistaken the steady thump of the bass for footsteps. But at that moment she was convinced it was Alexis Machine, and he was returning, a man so dedicated and so murderous that not even death would stop him. For the first time in her life, Dodie Eberhardt fainted. She came to less than 3 minutes later. Her legs would still not support her, so she crawled back down the short apartment hallway to the door with her hair hanging in her face. She thought of opening the door and looking out, but could not bring herself to do it. She turned the thumb lock instead, then shot the bolt and clicked the police bar into its steel foot. Those things done, she sat against the door, gasping, the world a gray blur. She was vaguely aware that she had locked herself in with a mutilated corpse, but that wasn't so bad. It wasn't bad at all when you considered the alternatives. Little by little, her strength came back, and she was able to get to her feet. She slipped around the corner at the end of the hall and then into the kitchen where the phone was. She kept her eyes averted from what remained of Mr. Big Shot, although it was an empty exercise. She would see that mind photograph in all its hideous clarity for a long time to come. She called the police, and when they came, she wouldn't let them in until one of them slid his ID under the door. "What's your wife's name?" she asked the cop, whose laminated badge identified him as Charles F. Toomey, Jr. Her voice was high and quivery, utterly unlike her usual one. Close friends, had she had any, would not have recognized it. "Stephanie, ma'am," the voice on the other side of the door replied patiently.
"I can call your station house and check that, you know,"
she nearly shrieked. "I know you can, Mrs. Eberhardt," the voice responded. "But you'd feel safer quicker if you just let us in, don't you think?" And because she still recognized the voice of cop as easily as she had recognized the smell of bad, she unlocked the door and let Toomey and his partner in. Once they were, Dodie did something else she had never done before. She went into hysterics. Chapter 7 Police Business 1 Thad was upstairs in his study, writing, when the police came. Liz was reading a book in the living room while William and Wendy goofed with each other in the oversized playpen they shared. She went to the door, looking out through one of the narrow ornamental windows which flanked it, before opening it. This was a habit she had gotten into since what was jokingly called Thad's debut in People magazine. Visitors, vague acquaintances for the most part, with a generous mixture of curious town residents and even a few total strangers, these latter unanimously Stark fans, thrown in for good measure, had taken to dropping by. Thad called it the "see the living crocodiles" syndrome, and said it would peter out in another week or two. Liz hoped he was right. In the meantime, she worried that one of the new callers might be a mad crocodile hunter of the sort who had killed John Lennon, and peeped through the side window first. She didn't know if she would recognize a bona fide madman if she saw one, but she could at least keep Thad's train of thought from derailing during the 2 hours each morning he spent writing. After that, he went to the door himself, usually throwing her a guilty little boy look to which she didn't know how to respond. The three men on the front doorstep this Saturday morning were not fans of either Beaumont or Stark, she guessed, and not madmen either, unless some of the current crop had taken to driving state police cruisers. She opened the door, feeling the uneasy twinge even the most blameless people must feel when the police show up without being called. She supposed if she'd had children old enough to be out whooping and hollering this rainy Saturday morning, she would already be wondering if they were okay. Yes? Are you Mrs. Elizabeth Beaumont? One of them asked. Yes, I am. May I help you? Is your husband home, Mrs. Beaumont? A second asked. These two were wearing identical gray rain slickers and state police hats. No, that's the ghost of Ernest Hemingway you hear clacking away upstairs, she thought of saying, and of course didn't. First came the has anybody had an accident fright, then the phantom guilt which made you want to come out with something harsh or sarcastic, something which said, no matter what the actual words, go away, you are not wanted here. We have done nothing wrong. Go and find someone who has. May I ask why you'd like to see him? The third policeman was Alan Pangborn. Police business, Mrs. Beaumont, he said. May we speak with him, please? 2. Thad Beaumont did not keep anything resembling an organized journal, but he did sometimes write about the events in his own life which interested, amused, or frightened him. He kept these accounts in a bound ledger, and his wife did not care much for them. They gave her the creeps, in fact, although she had never told Thad so. Most were strangely passionless, almost as if a part of him was standing aside and reporting on his life with its own divorced and almost disinterested eye. Following the visit of the police on the morning of June 4th, he wrote a long entry with a strong and unusual subcurrent of emotion running through it. I understand Kafka's The Trial and Orwell's 1984 a little better now, Thad wrote. To read them as political novels and no more is a serious mistake. I suppose the depression I went through after finishing Dancers and discovering there was nothing waiting behind it, except for Liz's miscarriage, that is, still counts as the most wrenching emotional experience of our married life. But what happened today seems worse. I tell myself it's because the experience is still fresh, but I suspect it's a lot more than that. I suppose if my time in the darkness and the loss of those first twins are wounds which have healed, leaving only scars to mark the places where they were, then this new wound will also heal. But I don't believe time will ever gloss it over completely. It will also leave its scar, one which is shorter but deeper, like the fading tattoo of a sudden knife slash. I'm sure the police behaved according to their oaths, if they still take them, and I guess they do. Yet there was then, and still is now, a feeling that I was in danger of being pulled into some faceless bureaucratic machine. Not men, but a machine which would go methodically on about its business until it had chewed me to rags. Because chewing people to rags is the machine's business. The sound of my screams would neither hurry nor delay that machine's chewing action. I could tell Liz was nervous when she came upstairs and told me the police wanted to see me about something, but wouldn't tell her what it was. She said one of them was Alan Pangborn, the Castle County Sheriff. I may have met him once or twice before, but I only really recognized him because his picture is in the Castle Rock Call from time to time. I was curious and grateful for a break from the typewriter, where my people have been insisting on doing things I don't want them to do for the last week. If I thought anything, I suppose I thought it might have something to do with Frederick Clausen, or some bit of fallout from the People article. I don't know if I can get the tone of the meeting which followed right or not. I don't know if it even matters, only that it seems important to try. They were standing in the hall near the foot of the stairs, three large men, it's no wonder people call them bulls, dripping a little water onto the carpet. "Are you Thaddeus Beaumont?" one of them, it was Sheriff Pangborn, asked. And that's when the emotional change I want to describe, or at least indicate, began to happen. Puzzlement joined the curiosity and pleasure at being released, however briefly, from the typewriter. And a little worry. My full name, but no Mister. like a judge addressing a defendant upon whom he is about to pass sentence. "Yes, that's right," I said, "and you're Sheriff Pangborn. I know, because we've got a place on Castle Lake." Then I put out my hand, that old automatic gesture of the well-trained American male. He just looked at it, and an expression came over his face. It was as if he'd opened the door of his refrigerator and discovered the fish he'd bought for supper had spoiled. "I have no intention of shaking your hand," he said, "so you might as well put it back down again and save us both some embarrassment." It was a hell of a strange thing to say, a downright rude thing to say. But that didn't bother me as much as the way he said it. It was as if he thought I was out of my mind. And just like that, I was terrified. Even now, I find it difficult to believe how rapidly, how goddamn rapidly, my emotions lensed through the spectrum from ordinary curiosity and some pleasure at the break in an accustomed routine to naked fear. In that instant, I knew they weren't here just to talk to me about something, but because they believed I had done something. And in that first moment of horror, "I have no intention of shaking your hand," I was sure that I had. That's what I need to express. In the moment of dead silence that followed Pangborn's refusal to shake my hand, I thought, in fact, that I had done everything and would be powerless not to confess my guilt. 3. Thad lowered his hand slowly. From the corner of his eye, he could see Liz with her hands clasped into a tight white ball between her breasts. And suddenly he wanted to be furious at this cop, who had been invited freely into his home and had then refused to shake his hand. This cop, whose salary was paid, at least in some small part, by the taxes the Beaumonts paid on their house in Castle Rock. This cop who had frightened Liz. This cop who had frightened him. "Very well," Thad said evenly. "If you won't shake hands with me, then perhaps you'll tell me why you're here." Unlike the state cops, Alan Pangborn was wearing not a rain slicker but a waterproof jacket which came only to his waist. He reached into his back pocket, brought out a card, and began to read from it. It took Thad a moment to realize he was hearing a variation of the Miranda warning. "As you said, my name is Alan Pangborn, Mr. Beaumont. I am the sheriff of Castle County, Maine. I'm here because I have to question you in connection with a capital crime. I will ask you these questions at the Orono State Police Barracks. You have the right to remain silent." "Oh, dear Jesus, please, what is this?" Liz asked, and layered on top of that, Thad heard himself saying, "Wait a minute, wait just a damn minute." He intended to roar this, but even with his brain telling his lungs to turn the volume up to a full lecture hall quieting bellow, the best he could manage was a mild objection that Pangborn overrode easily. "And you have the right to legal counsel. If you cannot afford legal counsel, such will be provided for you." He replaced the card in his back pocket.
"Thad?"
Liz was crowding against him like a small child frightened by thunder. Her huge, puzzled eyes stared at Pangborn. Every so often they flicked to the state troopers, who looked big enough to play defense on a pro football team, but mostly they remained on Pangborn. "I'm not going anywhere with you," Thad said. His voice was shaking, jigging up and down, changing registers like the voice of a young adolescent. He was still trying to be furious. "I don't believe you can compel me to do that." One of the troopers cleared his throat. "The alternative," he said, "is for us to go back and get a warrant for your arrest, Mr. Beaumont. On the basis of information in our possession, that would be very easy." The trooper glanced at Pangborn. "It might be fair to add that Sheriff Pangborn wanted us to bring one with us. He argued very strongly for it, and I guess he would have gotten his way if you weren't something of a public figure." Pangborn looked disgusted, possibly by this fact, possibly because the trooper was informing Thad of the fact, most likely both. The trooper saw the look, shuffled his wet shoes as if a trifle embarrassed, but pushed on anyway. "With the situation being what it is, I have no problem with you knowing that." He looked questioningly at his partner, who nodded. Pangborn just went on looking disgusted and angry. "He looks," Thad thought, "as if he'd like to rip me open with his fingernails and wrap my guts around my head." "That sounds very professional," Thad said. He was relieved to find he was getting at least some of his wind back and his voice was settling down. He wanted to be angry because anger would allay the fear, but he could still manage no more than bewilderment. He felt sucker-punched. What it ignores is the fact that I don't have the slightest idea what this goddamn situation is.
If we believed that to be the case, we wouldn't be here, Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said.
The expression of loathing on his face finally turned the trick. Thad was suddenly infuriated.
I don't care what you think, Thad said. I told you that I know who you are, Sheriff Pangborn. My wife and I have owned a summer house in Castle Rock since 1973, long before you ever heard of the place. I don't know what you're doing here, 160-odd miles from your territory, or why you're looking at me like I was a splat of bird shit on a new car, but I can tell you I'm not going anywhere with you until I find out. If it's going to take an arrest warrant, you go on and get one. But I want you to know that if you do, you're going to be up to your neck in a kettle of boiling shit, and I'll be the one underneath stoking the fire, because I haven't done anything. This is fucking outrageous, just fucking outrageous.
Now his voice had reached full volume, and both the troopers looked a little abashed. Pangborn did not. He went on staring at Thad in that unsettling way. In the other room, one of the twins began to cry.
Oh, Jesus, Liz moaned. What is this? Tell us.
Go take care of the kids, babe, Thad said, not unlocking his gaze from Pangborn's.
But please, he said,
and then both babies were crying. This will be all right. She gave him a final trembling look, her eyes saying, Do you promise? And then went into the living room.
We want to question you in connection with the murder of Homer Gamache, the second trooper said.
Thad broke his hard stare at Pangborn and turned to the trooper.
Who?
Homer Gamache, Pangborn repeated.
Are you going to tell us the name means nothing to you, Mr. Beaumont?
Of course I'm not, Thad said, astonished. Homer takes our trash to the dump when we're in town. Makes some small repairs around the house. He lost an arm in Korea. They gave him the Silver Star.
Bronze, Pangborn said stonily.
Homer's dead? Who killed him? The troopers now looked at each other, surprised. After grief, astonishment may be the most difficult human emotion to fake effectively. The first trooper replied in a curiously gentle voice,
We have reason to believe you did, Mr. Beaumont. That's why we're here.
4. Thad looked at him with utter blankness for a moment, and then laughed.
Jesus! Jesus Christ, this is crazy!
Do you want to get a coat, Mr. Beaumont? The other trooper asked. Raining pretty hard out there.
I'm not going anywhere with you, he repeated absently, entirely missing Pangborn's sudden expression of exasperation. Thad was thinking.
I'm afraid you are, Pangborn said, one way or the other.
It'll have to be the other, then, he said, and then came out of himself.
When did this happen?
Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said, speaking slowly and enunciating carefully. It was as if he were speaking to a 4-year-old and not a terribly bright one at that. We're not here to give you information.
Liz came back into the doorway with the babies. All color had drained from her face. Her forehead shone like a lamp.
This is crazy, she said, looking from Pangborn to the troopers and then back to Pangborn again. Crazy! Don't you know that?
Listen, Thad said, walking over to Liz and putting an arm around her. I didn't kill Homer, Sheriff Pangborn, but I understand now why you're so pissed. Come on upstairs to my office. Let's sit down and see if we can't figure this out.
I want you to get your coat, Pangborn said. He glanced at Liz.
Forgive my French, but I've had about all the bullshit I can put up with for a rainy Saturday morning. We have you cold.
Thad looked at the older of the two state troopers.
Can you talk some sense to this man? Tell him that he can avoid a whole lot of embarrassment and trouble just by telling me when Homer was killed?
And as an afterthought,
and where?
If it was in the Rock and I can't imagine what Homer would be doing up here, well, I haven't been out of Ludlow except to go to the university in the last 2.5 months.
He looked at Liz, who nodded.
The trooper thought it over and then said, Excuse us a moment. The three of them went back down the hallway, the troopers almost appearing to lead Pangborn. They went out the front door. As soon as it was shut, Liz burst into a spate of confused questions. Thad knew her well enough to suspect her terror would have come out as anger, fury even, at the cops, if not for the news of Homer Gamache's death. As things were, she was on the edge of tears. "It's going to be all right," he said, and kissed her on the cheek. As an afterthought, he also bussed William and Wendy, who were beginning to look decidedly troubled. "I think the state troopers already know I'm telling the truth. Pangborn, well, he knew Homer. You did too. He's just pissed as hell. And from the look and sound of him, he must have what seems like unshakable evidence tying me to the murder," he thought, but did not add. He walked down the hall and peered out the narrow side window as Liz had done. If not for the situation, what he saw would have been funny. The three of them were standing on the stoop, almost but not quite out of the rain, having a conference. Thad could get the sound of their voices, but not the sense. He thought they looked like ballplayers conferring on the mound during a late-inning rally by the other team. Both state cops were talking to Pangborn, who was shaking his head and replying heatedly. Thad went back down the hall. "What are they doing?" Liz asked. "I don't know," Thad said, "but I think the state cops are trying to talk Pangborn into telling me why he's so sure I killed Homer Gamache, or at least some of the why." "Poor Homer," she muttered. "This is like a bad dream." He took William from her and told her again not to worry. 5. The policeman came in about 2 minutes later. Pangborn's face was a thundercloud. Thad surmised the two state cops had told him what Pangborn himself already knew but didn't want to admit. The writer was exhibiting none of the tics and twitches they associated with guilt. "All right," Pangborn said. He was trying to avoid surliness, Thad thought, and doing a pretty good job. Not quite succeeding, but doing a pretty good job all the same, considering he was in the presence of his number one suspect in the murder of a one-armed old man. "These gentlemen would like me to ask you at least one question here, Mr. Beaumont, and so I will. Can you account for your whereabouts during the time period from 11 p.m. on May 31st until 4 a.m. on June 1st? The Beaumonts exchanged a glance. Thad felt a great weight around his heart loosen. It did not quite fall off, not yet, but he felt as if all the catches holding that weight had been unbuckled. Now all it would take was one good push. "Was it?" he murmured to his wife. He thought it was, but it seemed just a little too good to be true. "I'm sure it was," Liz responded. "The 31st, did you say?" She was looking at Pangborn with radiant hope. Pangborn looked back suspiciously. "Yes, ma'am, but I'm afraid your unsubstantiated word won't be—" She was ignoring him, counting backward on her fingers. Suddenly she grinned like a schoolgirl. "Tuesday! Tuesday was the 31st," she cried to her husband. "It was! Thank God!" Pangborn looked puzzled and more suspicious than ever. The troopers looked at each other and then looked back at Liz.
"You want to let us in on it, Mrs. Beaumont?" one asked.
"We had a party here the night of Tuesday the 31st, she replied, and flashed Pangborn a look of triumph and vicious dislike. "We had a house full, didn't we, Thad?"
"We sure did."
"In a case like this, a good alibi itself is cause for suspicion," Pangborn said, but he looked off balance. "Oh, you silly, arrogant man," Liz exclaimed. Bright color now flamed in her cheeks. Fear was passing. Fury was arriving. She looked at the troopers. "If my husband doesn't have an alibi for this murder you say he committed, you take him to the police station. If he does, this man says it probably means he did it anyway. What are you, afraid of a little honest work? Why are you here?"
"Quit now, Liz," Thad said quietly. "They've got good reasons for being here. If Sheriff Pangborn were on a wild goose chase or running on hunch, I believe he would come alone."
Pangborn gave him a sour look, then sighed.
"Tell us about this party, Mr. Beaumont."
"It was for Tom Carroll," Thad said. "Tom has been in the University English Department for 19 years, and he's been chairman for the last 5. He retired on May 27th, when the academic year officially ended. He's always been a great favorite in the department, known to most of us old war horses as Gonzo Tom because of his great liking for Hunter Thompson's essays. So we decided to throw a retirement party for him and his wife."
"What time did this party end?"
Thad grinned. "Well, it was over before 4 in the morning, but it ran late. When you put a bunch of English teachers together with an almost unlimited supply of booze, you could burn down a weekend. Guests started arriving around 8 and—" "Who was last, honey?" Raleigh de Lesseps and that awful woman from the history department he's been going out with since Jesus was a baby, she said. The one who goes around blaring, "Just call me Billy, everyone does." Right, Thad said. He was grinning now. The Wicked Witch of the East. Pangborn's eyes were sending a clear, "You're lying and we both know it" message. And what time did these friends leave? Thad shuddered a little. Friends? Raleigh, yes. That woman most definitely not.
2 o'clock, Liz said.
Thad nodded. It had to have been at least 2 when we saw them out. Damn near poured them out. As I indicated, it will be a snowy day in hell before I'm inducted into the Wilhelmina Burks fan club, but I would have insisted they stay over if he'd had more than 3 miles to drive or if it had been earlier. No one on the roads at that hour on a Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, sorry. Anyhow. Except maybe a few deer raiding the gardens. He shut his mouth abruptly. In his relief, he was close to babbling. There was a moment's silence. The 2 troopers were now looking at the floor. Pangborn had an expression on his face Thad could not read. He didn't believe he had ever seen it before. Not chagrin, although chagrin was a part of it. What in the fuck is going on here? Well, that's very convenient, Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said at last. But it's a long way from rock solid. We've got the word of you and your wife, or guesstimate, as to when you saw this last couple out. If they were as blasted as you seem to think, they'll hardly be able to corroborate what you've said. And if this de Lesseps fellow really is a friend, he might say, well, who knows? All the same, Alan Pangborn was losing steam. Thad saw it and believed, no, knew, the state troopers did too. Yet the man wasn't ready to let it go. The fear Thad had felt initially and the anger which had followed it were changing to fascination and curiosity. He thought he had never seen puzzlement and certainty so equally at war. The fact of the party, and he must accept as fact something which could so easily be checked, had shaken him, but not convinced him. Nor, he saw, were the troopers entirely convinced. The only difference was that the troopers weren't so hot under the collar. They hadn't known Homer Gamache personally, and so they didn't have any personal stake in this. Alan Pangborn had, and did. I knew him too, Thad thought. So maybe I have a stake in it too. Apart from my hide, that is. Look, he said patiently, keeping his gaze locked with Pangborn's and trying not to return hostility in kind. Let's get real, as my students like to say. You asked if we could effectively prove our whereabouts. Your whereabouts, Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said. Okay, my whereabouts. 5 pretty difficult hours, hours when most people are in bed. Thanks to nothing more than blind luck, I, if you prefer, can cover at least 3 of those 5 hours. Maybe Raleigh and his odious lady friend left at 2, maybe they left at 1:30 or 2:15. Whenever it was late. They'll corroborate that, and the Burks woman wouldn't lie me an alibi even if Raleigh would. I think if Billy Burks saw me wash up drowning on the beach, she'd throw a bucket of water on me. Liz gave him an odd, grimacing little smile as she took William, who was beginning to squirm, from him. At first he didn't understand that smile, and then it came to him. It was that phrase, of course, lie me an alibi. It was a phrase which Alexis Machine, arch-villain of the George Stark novels, sometimes used. It was odd, in a way. He could not remember ever using a Starkism in conversation before. On the other hand, he had never been accused of murder before either, and murder was a George Stark kind of situation. Even supposing we're off by an hour and the last guests left at 1, he continued, and further supposing I jumped into my car the second they were gone over the hill, and then drove like a mad bastard for Castle Rock, it would be 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning before I could possibly get there. No turnpike going west, you know. One of the troopers began, and the Arsinoe woman said it was about 1:15 when she saw... We don't need to go into that right now, Alan interrupted quickly. Liz made a rude, exasperated sound, and Wendy goggled at her comically. In the crook of her other arm, William stopped squirming, suddenly engrossed in the wonderfulness of his own twiddling fingers. To Thad, she said, There were still lots of people here at 1, Thad, lots of them. Then she rounded on Alan Pangborn, really rounded on him this time.
What is wrong with you, Sheriff? Why are you so bullheadedly determined to lay this off on my husband? Are you a stupid man? A lazy man? A bad man? You don't look like any of those things, but your behavior makes me wonder. It makes me wonder very much. Perhaps it was a lottery. Was that it? Did you draw his name out of a fucking hat?
Alan recoiled slightly, clearly surprised and discomfited by her ferocity.
Mrs. Beaumont, I have the advantage, I'm afraid, Sheriff, Thad said. You think I killed Homer Gamache.
Mr. Beaumont, you have not been charged with...
No, but you think it, don't you?
Color, solid and brick-like, not embarrassment, Thad thought, but frustration, had been slowly climbing into Pangborn's cheeks like color in a thermometer.
Yes, sir, he said, I do think it, in spite of the things you and your wife have said.
This reply filled Thad with wonder. What in God's name could have happened to make this man, who, as Liz had said, did not look at all stupid, so sure? So goddamned sure.
Thad felt a shiver go up his spine. And then a peculiar thing happened. A phantom sound filled his mind, not his head, but his mind, for a moment. It was a sound which imparted an aching sense of déjà vu, for it had been almost 30 years since he had last heard it. It was the ghostly sound of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of small birds. He put a hand up to his head and touched the small scar there, and the shiver came again, stronger this time, twisting through his flesh like wire.
Lie me an alibi, George, he thought. I'm in a bit of a tight here, so lie me an alibi.
Thad? Liz asked. Are you all right?
Hmm? He looked around at her.
You're pale.
I'm fine, he said. And he was. The sound was gone, if it had really been there at all. He turned back to Pangborn.
As I said, Sheriff, I have a certain advantage in this matter. You think I killed Homer. I, however, no, I didn't. Except in books, I've never killed anyone.
Mr. Beaumont, I understand your outrage. He was a nice old man with an overbearing wife, a funky sense of humor, and only one arm. I'm outraged, too. I'll do anything I can to help, but you'll have to drop this secret police stuff and tell me why you're here. What in the world led you to me in the first place? I'm bewildered.
Alan looked at him for a very long time and then said, Every instinct in my body says you are telling the truth.
Thank God, Liz said. The man sees sense.
If it turns out you are, Alan said, looking only at Thad, I will personally find the person in ASR and I who screwed up this ID and pull his skin off.
What's AS and whatever? Liz asked.
Armed Services Records and Identification, one of the troopers said. Washington.
I've never known them to screw up before, Alan went on in the same slow tone. They say there's a first time for everything, but if they haven't screwed up, and if this party of yours checks out, I'm going to be pretty damned bewildered myself.
Can't you tell us what this is all about? Thad asked.
Alan sighed.
We've come this far. Why not? In all truth, the last guests to leave your party don't matter that much anyway. If you were here at midnight, if there are witnesses who can swear you were 25 at least, Liz said, then you're off the hook. Putting together the eyewitness account of the lady the trooper mentioned and the medical examiner's post-mortem, we can be almost positive Homer was killed between 1 and 3 a.m. on June 1st. He was bludgeoned to death with his own prosthetic arm.
Dear Jesus, Liz muttered. And you thought Thad...
Homer's truck was found 2 nights ago in the parking lot of a rest stop on I-95 in Connecticut, close to the New York border. Alan paused. There were fingerprints all over it, Mr. Beaumont. Most were Homer's, but a good many belonged to the perpetrator. Several of the perps were excellent. One was almost moulage cast in a wad of gum the guy took out of his mouth and then stuck on the dashboard with his thumb. It hardened there. The best one of all, though, was on the rearview mirror. It was every bit as good as a print made in a police station, only the one on the mirror was rolled in blood instead of ink.
Then why Thad? Liz was demanding indignantly. Party or no party, how could you think that Thad... Alan looked at her and said, "When the people at ASR&I fed the prints into their graphics computer, your husband's service record came back. Your husband's prints came back, to be exact." For a moment, Thad and Liz could only look at each other, stunned to silence. Then Liz said, "It was a mistake, then. Surely the people who check these things do make mistakes from time to time." "Yes, but they're rarely mistakes of this magnitude. There are gray areas in print identification, sure. Laymen who grow up watching shows like Kojak and Barnaby Jones get the idea that fingerprinting is an exact science, and it isn't. But computerization has taken a lot of the grays out of print comparisons, and this case yielded prints which were extraordinarily good. When I say they were your husband's prints, Mrs. Beaumont, I mean what I say. I've seen the computer sheets and I've seen the overlays. The match is not just close." Now he turned back to Thad and stared at him with his flinty blue eyes. "The match is exact." Liz stared at him with her mouth open, and in her arms, first William and then Wendy began to cry. Chapter 8. Pangborn Pays a Visit. 1. When the doorbell rang again at 7:15 that evening, it was Liz again who went to answer it, because she was done getting William ready for bed, and Thad was still hard at work on Wendy. The books all said parenting was a learned skill which had nothing to do with the sex of the parent, but Liz had her doubts. Thad pulled his weight, was in fact scrupulous about doing his share, but he was slow. He could whip out to the store and back on a Sunday afternoon in the time it took her to work her way over to the last aisle, but when it came to getting the twins ready for bed, well. William was bathed, freshly diapered, zippered into his green sleep suit, and sitting in the playpen while Thad was still laboring over Wendy's diapers, and he hadn't gotten all the soap out of her hair, she saw, but considering the day they'd put in, she believed she'd get it herself with a washcloth later on and say nothing. Liz walked through the living room to the front door and looked out the side window. She saw Sheriff Pangborn standing outside. He was alone this time, but that didn't do much to alleviate her distress. She turned her head and called across the living room and into the downstairs bathroom cum baby service station. "He's back!" Her voice carried a clearly discernible note of alarm. There was a long pause, and then Thad came into the doorway on the far side of the parlor. He was barefoot, wearing jeans and a white T-shirt. "Who?" he said in an odd, slow voice. "Pangborn," she said. "Thad, are you okay?" Wendy was in his arms, wearing her diaper but nothing else, and she had her hands all over his face, but the little Liz could see of him just didn't look right. "I'm fine. Let him in. I'll get this one in her suit." And before Liz could say anything else, he was abruptly gone. Alan Pangborn, meanwhile, was still standing patiently on the stoop. He had seen Liz look out and hadn't rung again. He had the air of a man who wished he had worn a hat so he could hold it in his hands, perhaps even wring it a little. Slowly, and with no welcoming smile at all, she took the chain off and let him in. 2. Wendy was wiggly and full of fun, which made her hard to handle. Thad managed to get her feet into the sleep suit, then her arms, and was finally able to pop her hands out of the cuffs. She immediately reached up with one of them and honked his nose briskly. He recoiled instead of laughing as he usually did, and Wendy looked up at him from the changing table in mild puzzlement. He reached for the zipper which ran up the suit from the left leg to the throat, then stopped and held his hands out in front of him. They were shaking. It was a tiny tremble, but it was there. "What the hell are you scared about? Or do you have the guilts again?" "No, not the guilts." He almost wished it was. The fact was, he just had another scare in a day which had been too full of them. First had come the police, with their odd accusation and their even odder certainty. Then that strange, haunted cheeping sound. He hadn't known what it was, not for sure, although it had been familiar. After supper, it had come again. He had gone up to his study to proof what he had done on the new book, The Golden Dog, that day. And suddenly, as he was bending over the sheaf of manuscript to make a minor correction, the sound filled his head. Thousands of birds, all cheeping and twittering at once, and this time an image came with the sound. Sparrows. thousands and thousands of them, lined up along roof peaks and jostling for place along the telephone wires, the way they did in the early spring, while the last snows of March were still lying on the ground in dirty little granulated piles. "Oh, the headache is coming," he thought with dismay, and the voice in which that thought spoke, the voice of a frightened boy, was what tipped familiarity over into memory. Terror leaped up his throat then and seemed to clutch at the sides of his head with freezing hands. "Is it the tumor? Has it come back? Is it malignant this time?" The phantom sound, the voices of the birds, grew suddenly louder, almost deafening. It was joined by a thin, tenebrous flutter of wings. Now he could see them taking off, all of them at once, thousands of small birds darkening a white spring sky.
"Gonna hook back north, hoss," he heard himself say in a low, guttural voice, a voice which was not his own.
Then, suddenly, the sight and sound of the birds was gone. It was 1988, not 1960, and he was in his study. He was a grown man with a wife, two kids, and a Remington typewriter. He had drawn a long, gasping breath. There had been no ensuing headache. Not then, not now. He felt fine. Except when he looked down at the sheaf of manuscript again, he saw that he had written something there. It was slashed across the lines of neat type in large capital letters. "The sparrows are flying again," he had written. He had discarded the scripto pen and used one of the barrel black beauties to write it, although he had no memory of trading one for the other. He didn't even use the pencils anymore. The barrels belonged to a dead age, a dark age. He tossed the pencil he had used back into the jar and then bundled the whole thing into one of the drawers. The hand he used to do this was not quite steady. Then Liz had called him to help get the twins ready for bed, and he had gone down to help her. He had wanted to tell her what had happened, but found that simple terror that the childhood tumor had recurred, terror that this time it would be malignant, had sealed his lips. He might have told her just the same, but then the doorbell had rung. Liz had gone to answer it, and she had said exactly the wrong thing in exactly the wrong tone. "He's back," Liz had cried in perfectly understandable irritation and dismay, and terror had swept through him like a cold, clear gust of wind. Terror, and one word. Stark. In the 1 second before reality reasserted itself, he was positive that was who she meant. George Stark. The sparrows were flying, and Stark had returned. He was dead, dead and publicly buried. He had never really existed in the first place, but that didn't matter, real or not. He was back just the same. "Quit it," he told himself. "You're not a jumpy man, and there's no need to let this bizarre situation make you into one. The sound you heard, the sound of the birds, is a simple psychological phenomenon called persistence of memory. It's brought on by stress and pressure, so just get yourself under control." But some of the terror lingered. The sound of the birds had caused not only déjà vu, that sense of having experienced something before, but presque vu as well. Presque vu, a sense of experiencing something which has not happened yet, but will. Not precognition, exactly, but misplaced memory. Misplaced bullshit, that's what you mean. He held his hands out and looked fixedly at them. The trembling became infinitesimal, then stopped altogether. When he was sure he wasn't going to pinch Wendy's bath pink skin into the zipper of her sleep suit, he pulled it up, carried her into the living room, popped her into the playpen with her brother, then went out to the hall where Liz was standing with Alan Pangborn. Except for the fact that Pangborn was alone this time, it could have been this morning, all over again. "Now this is a legitimate time and place for a little voo of one kind or another," he thought. But there was nothing funny in it. That other feeling was still too much with him, and the sound of the sparrows. "What can I do for you, Sheriff?" he asked, not smiling. "Ah, something else that wasn't the same." Pangborn had a six-pack in one hand. Now he held it up. "I wondered if we could have a cold one," he said, "and talk this over." 3. Liz and Alan Pangborn both had a beer. Thad drank a Pepsi from the fridge. As they talked, they watched the twins play with each other in their oddly solemn way.
"I have no business being here," Alan said. "I'm socializing with a man who is now a suspect in not just one murder, but two."
"Two?" Liz cried.
"I'll get to it. In fact, I'll get to everything. I guess I'm going to spill it all. For one thing, I'm sure your husband has an alibi for this second murder as well. The state cops are, too. They're quietly running around in circles."
"Who's been killed?" Thad asked.
"A young man named Frederick Clawson in Washington, D.C. He watched as Liz jerked in her chair, spilling a little beer over the back of her hand. "I see you know the name, Mrs. Beaumont," he added without noticeable irony.
"What's going on?"
she asked in a strengthless whisper.
"I don't have the slightest idea what's going on.
I'm going crazy trying to figure it out. I'm not here to arrest you or even to hassle you, Mr. Beaumont. Although I'll be goddamned if I can understand how someone else can have committed these two crimes. I'm here to ask for your help."
"Why don't you call me Thad?"
Alan shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"I think I'd be more comfortable with Mr. Beaumont for the time being."
Thad nodded.
"Just as you like." "So Clawson's dead."
He looked down meditatively for a moment, then up at Alan again. "Were my fingerprints all over the scene of this crime as well?"
"Yes,
and in more ways than one. People magazine did a write-up on you recently, didn't they, Mr. Beaumont?"
2 weeks ago," Thad agreed.
"The article was found in Clawson's apartment. One page appears to have been used as a symbol in what looks like a highly ritualized murder."
"Christ," Liz said.
She sounded both tired and horrified. "Are you willing to tell me who he is to you?" Alan asked. Thad nodded.
"There's no reason not to. Did you happen to read that article, Sheriff?"
"My wife brings the magazine home from the supermarket," he said, "but I better tell you the truth. I only looked at the pictures. I intend to go back and read the text as soon as I can."
"You didn't miss much, but Frederick Clawson is the reason that article happened.
You see," Alan held up a hand, "we'll get to him, but let's go back to Homer Gamache first. We've rechecked with ASR&I. The prints on Gamache's truck and in Clawson's apartment, too, although none of them are as perfect as the bubblegum print and the mirror print, do seem to match yours exactly, which means if you didn't do it, we have two people with exactly the same prints, and that one belongs in the Guinness Book of World Records." He looked at William and Wendy, who were trying to play pat a cake in their playpen. They seemed to be mostly endangering each other's eyesight.
"Are they identical?" he asked.
"No," Liz said. "They do look alike, but they're brother and sister. And brother-sister twins are never identical."
Alan nodded.
"Not even identical twins have identical prints," he said.
He paused for a moment and then added in a casual voice, which Thad believed was completely counterfeit,
"You don't happen to have a twin brother, do you, Mr. Beaumont?"
Thad shook his head slowly.
"No," he said. "I don't have any siblings at all, and my folks are dead. William and Wendy are my only living blood relatives."
He smiled at the children, then looked back at Pangborn.
"Liz had a miscarriage back in 1974, he said. Those first ones were also twins, I understand, although I don't suppose there's any way of telling if they would have been identical, not when the miscarriage comes in the third month. And if there is, who would want to know?"
Alan shrugged, looking a little embarrassed.
"She was shopping at Filene's in Boston. Someone pushed her. She fell all the way down an escalator, cut one arm pretty badly. If a security cop hadn't been there to put a tourniquet right on it, it would have been touch and go for her, too, and she lost the twins."
"Is this in the People article?" Alan asked.
Liz smiled humorlessly and shook her head.
"We reserved the right to edit our lives when we agreed to do the story, Sheriff Pangborn. We didn't tell Mike Donaldson, the man who came to do the interview, of course, but that's what we did."
"Was the push deliberate?"
"No way to tell," Liz said.
Her eyes settled on William and Wendy, brooded upon them.
If it was an accidental bump, it was a damned hard one, though. I went flying. Didn't touch the escalator at all until I was almost halfway down. All the same, I've tried to convince myself that's what it was. It's easier to get along with. The idea that someone would push a woman down a steep escalator just to see what happened, that's an idea guaranteed to keep you awake nights.
Alan nodded. The doctors we saw told us Liz would probably never have another child, Thad said. When she got pregnant with William and Wendy, they told us she'd probably never carry them all the way to term. But she sailed through it. And after 10 years, I've finally gotten to work on a new book under my own name. It'll be my third. So you see, it's been good for both of us.
The other name you wrote under was George Stark.
Thad nodded.
But that's over now. It started being over when Liz got into her 8th month, still safe and sound. I decided if I was going to be a father again, I ought to start being myself again as well.
4. There was a kind of beat in the conversation then, not quite a pause. Then Thad said, "Confess, Sheriff Pangborn." Alan raised his eyebrows. "Beg your pardon?" A smile touched the corners of Thad's mouth.
"I won't say you had the scenario all worked out, but I bet you at least had the broad strokes. If I had an identical twin brother, maybe he hosted our party. That way, I could have been in Castle Rock, murdering Homer Gamache and putting my fingerprints all over his truck. But it couldn't stop there, could it? My twin sleeps with my wife and keeps my appointments while I drive Homer's truck to that rest stop in Connecticut, steal another car there, drive to New York, ditch the hot car, then take a train or a plane to Washington, D.C. Once I'm there, I waste Clawson and hurry back to Ludlow, pack my twin off to wherever he was, and he and I both take up the threads of our lives again. Or all three of us, if you assume Liz here was part of the deception." Liz stared at him for a moment, and then began to laugh. She did not laugh long, but she laughed hard while she did. There was nothing forced about it, but it was grudging laughter all the same, an expression of humor from a woman who has been surprised into it. Alan was looking at Thad with frank and open surprise. The twins laughed at their mother for a moment, or perhaps with her, and then resumed rolling a large yellow ball slowly back and forth in the playpen. "Thad, that's horrible," Liz said when she had gained control of herself.
"Maybe it is," he said. "If so, I'm sorry."
"It's pretty involved," Alan said. Thad grinned at him.
"You're not a fan of the late George Stark, I take it."
"Frankly, no. But I have a deputy, Norris Ridgwick, who is. He had to explain to me what all the hoop-de-doo was about."
"Well, Stark messed with some of the conventions of the mystery story. Never anything so Agatha Christie as the scenario I just suggested, but that doesn't mean I can't think that way if I put my mind to it. Come on, Sheriff. Had the thought crossed your mind or not? If not, I really do owe my wife an apology."
Alan was silent for a moment, smiling a little and clearly thinking a lot. At last he said, "Maybe I was thinking along those lines. Not seriously and not just that way, but you don't have to apologize to your good lady. Since this morning, I've found myself willing to consider even the most outrageous possibilities."
"Given the situation?"
"Given the situation, yes."
Smiling himself, Thad said, "I was born in Bergenfield, New Jersey, Sheriff. There's no need to take my word when you can check the records for any twin brothers I may have, forgotten."
Alan shook his head and drank some more of his beer.
"It was a wild idea, and I feel a little like a horse's ass, but that's not completely new. I felt that way since this morning when you sprang that party on us. We ran down the names, by the way. They check out."
"Of course they do," Liz said with a touch of asperity.
"And since you don't have a twin brother anyway, it pretty well closes the subject."
"Suppose for a second," Thad said, "just for the sake of argument, that it did happen the way I suggested. It would make a hell of a yarn, up to a point."
"What point is that?" Alan asked.
"The fingerprints. Why would I go to all the trouble of setting up an alibi here, with a fellow who looked just like me, then bugger it all by leaving fingerprints at the scenes of the murders?"
Liz said, "I bet you really will check the birth records, won't you, Sheriff?"
Allen said stolidly. The basis of police procedure is beat it until it's dead. But I already know what I'll find if I do. He hesitated, then added, It wasn't just the party. You came across as a man who was speaking the truth, Mr. Beaumont. I've had some experience telling the difference. So far as I've been able to tell in my time as a police officer, there are very few good liars in the world. They may show up from time to time in those mystery novels you were talking about, but in real life, they're pretty rare.
So why the fingerprints at all? Thad asked. That's what interests me. Is it just an amateur with my prints you're looking for?
I doubt it. Has it crossed your mind that the very quality of the prints is suspect? You spoke of gray areas.
I know a little bit about prints as a result of the research I did for the Stark novels, but I'm really quite lazy when it comes to that end of the job. It's so much easier just to sit there in front of the typewriter and make up lies.
But don't there have to be a certain number of points of comparison before fingerprints can even be entered into evidence?
In Maine, it's 6, Allen said. 6 perfect compares have to be present for a fingerprint to be admitted as evidence.
And isn't it true that in most cases fingerprints are only half prints or quarter prints or just smudgy blurs with a few loops and whorls in them?
Yeah, in real life, criminals hardly ever go to jail on the basis of fingerprint evidence.
Yet here, you have one on the rearview mirror, which you described as being as good as any print rolled in a police station, and another all but molded in a wad of gum. Somehow that's the one that really gets me. It's as if the fingerprints were put there for you to find.
It's crossed our minds. In fact, it had done a good deal more. It was one of the most aggravating aspects of the case. The Clawson murder looked like a classic gangland hit on a blabbermouth. Tongue cut out, penis in the victim's mouth. Lots of blood, lots of pain. Yet no one in the building had heard a goddamn thing. But if it had been a professional job, how come Beaumont's prints were all over the place? Could anything which looked so much like a frame not be a frame? Not unless someone had come up with a brand new gimmick. In the meantime, the old maxim still held good with Alan Pangborn. If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and swims like a duck, it's probably a duck.
Can fingerprints be planted? Thad asked.
Do you read minds as well as write books, Mr. Beaumont?
Read minds, write books, but honey, I don't do windows.
Allen had a mouthful of beer, and laughter so surprised him that he almost sprayed it over the carpet. He managed to swallow, although some went down his windpipe and he began to cough. Liz got up and whammed him briskly on the back several times. It was perhaps an odd thing to do, but it did not strike her as odd. Life with two small babies had conditioned her. William and Wendy stared from the playpen. The yellow ball stopped dead and forgotten between them. William began to laugh. Wendy took her cue from him. For some reason, this made Allen laugh harder. Thad joined in, and, still pounding on his back, Liz also began to laugh.
I'm okay, Allen said, still coughing and laughing. Really?
Liz whacked him one final time. Beer splurted up the neck of Allen's bottle like a geyser letting off steam and splatted onto the crotch of his pants.
It's okay, Thad said. Diapers we got.
Then they were laughing all over again, and at some time between the moment when Alan Pangborn started coughing and the one when he finally managed to stop laughing, the three of them had become at least temporary friends. 5.
So far as I know or have been able to find out, fingerprints can't be planted, Alan said, picking up the thread of conversation some time later. By now they were on their second round, and the embarrassing stain on the crotch of his pants was beginning to dry. The twins had fallen asleep in the playpen, and Liz had left the room to go to the bathroom. Of course, we're still checking, because up until this morning we had no reason to suspect anything like that might even have been tried in this case. I know it has been tried. A few years ago, a kidnapper took imprints of his prisoner's finger pads before killing him, turned them into dyes, I suppose you'd call them, and stamped them into very thin plastic. He put the plastic fingertips over the pads of his own fingers and attempted to leave the prints all over his victim's mountain cabin so the police would think the whole kidnapping was a hoax and the guy was free.
It didn't work?
The cops got some lovely prints, Allen said. The perps. The natural oils on the guy's fingers flattened the counterfeit fingerprints,
and because the plastic was thin and naturally receptive to even the most delicate shapes, it rose up again in the guy's own prints. Maybe a different material?
Sure, maybe.
This happened in the mid-50s, and I imagine 100 new kinds of polymer plastic have been invented since then. It could be. All we can say for now is that no one in forensics or criminology has ever heard of it being done, and I think that's the way it'll stay.
Liz came back into the room and sat down, curling her feet under her like a cat and pulling her skirt over her calves. Thad admired the gesture, which seemed to him somehow timeless and eternally graceful.
Meantime, there are other considerations here, Thad.
Thad and Liz exchanged a flicker of a glance at Alan's use of the first name, so swift Alan missed it. He had drawn a battered notebook from his hip pocket and was looking at one of the pages.
"Do you smoke?" he asked, looking up.
"No."
"He quit 7 years ago," Liz said.
"It was very hard for him, but he stuck with it."
"There are critics who say the world would be a better place if I just pick a spot and die in it, but I choose to spite them," Thad said.
"Why?"
"You did smoke, though."
"Yes."
"Pall Malls?"
Thad had been raising his can of soda. It stopped 6 inches shy of his mouth.
"How did you know that?"
"Your blood type is A negative."
"I'm beginning to understand why you came primed to arrest me this morning," Thad said. "If I hadn't been so well alibied, I'd be in jail right now, wouldn't I?"
"Good guess."
"You could have gotten his blood type from his ROTC records," Liz said. "I assume that's where his fingerprints came from in the first place."
"But not that I smoked Pall Mall cigarettes for 15 years, Thad said. "So far as I know, stuff like that's not part of the records the Army keeps."
"This is stuff that's come in since this morning," Alan told them. "The ashtray in Homer Gamache's pickup was full of Pall Mall cigarette butts. The old man only smoked an occasional pipe. There were a couple of Pall Mall butts in an ashtray in Frederick Clausen's apartment as well. He didn't smoke at all, except maybe for a joint now and then. That's according to his landlady. We got our perp's blood type from the spittle on the butts. The serologist's report also gave us a lot of other information. Better than fingerprints."
Thad was no longer smiling.
"I don't understand this. I don't understand this at all."
"There's one thing which doesn't match," Pangborn said. "Blonde hairs. We found half a dozen in Homer's truck, and we found another on the back of the chair the killer used in Clausen's living room. Your hair is black. Somehow, I don't think you're wearing a rug."
"No, Thad's not, but maybe the killer was," Liz said bleakly.
"Maybe," Alan agreed.
"If so, it was made of human hair. And why bother changing the color of your hair if you're going to leave fingerprints and cigarette butts everywhere? Either the guy is very dumb or he was deliberately trying to implicate you. The blonde hair doesn't fit either way."
"Maybe he just didn't want to be recognized," Liz said. "Remember, Thad was in People magazine barely 2 weeks ago, coast to coast."
"Yeah, that's a possibility. Although if this guy also looks like your husband, Mrs. Beaumont..."
"Liz."
"Okay, Liz. If he looks like your husband, he'd look like Thad Beaumont with blonde hair, wouldn't he?"
Liz looked fixedly at Thad for a moment and then began to giggle.
"What's so funny?" Thad asked.
"I'm trying to imagine you blonde," she said, still giggling. "I think you'd look like a very depraved David Bowie."
"Is that funny?" Thad asked Alan.
"I don't think that's funny."
"Well," Alan said, smiling.
"Never mind. The guy could have been wearing sunglasses and dealy boppers as well as a blonde wig, for all we know."
"Not if the killer was the same guy Mrs. Arsenault saw getting into Homer's truck at 1:15 in the morning of June 1st, Alan said.
Thad leaned forward.
"Did he look like me?" he asked.
"She couldn't tell much except that he was wearing a suit. For what it's worth, I had one of my men, Norris Ridgwick, show her your picture today. She said she didn't think it was you, although she couldn't say for sure. She said she thought the man who got into Homer's truck was bigger." He added dryly, "That's one lady who believes in erring on the side of caution."
"She could tell a size difference from a picture?" Liz asked doubtfully.
"She's seen Thad around town summers," Alan said, "and she did say she couldn't be sure."
Liz nodded.
"Of course she knows him,
Both of us, for that matter. We buy fresh stuff at their vegetable stand all the time. Dumb. Sorry.
Nothing to apologize for, Alan said. He finished his beer and checked his crotch. Dry. Good. There was a light stain there, probably not anything anyone but his wife would notice.
Anyhow, that brings me to the last point, or aspect, or whatever the hell you want to call it. I doubt if it's even a part of this, but it never hurts to check. What's your shoe size, Mr. Beaumont?
Thad glanced at Liz, who shrugged.
I've got pretty small paws for a guy who goes 6'1", I guess. I take a size 10, although half a size either way is...
The prints reported to us were probably bigger than that, Alan said.
I don't think the prints are a part of it anyway, and even if they are, footprints can be faked. Stick some newspaper in the toes of shoes 2 or even 3 sizes too big for you and you're set.
What footprints are these? Thad asked.
Doesn't matter, Alan said, shaking his head. We don't even have photos. I think we've got almost everything on the table that belongs there, Thad. Your fingerprints, your blood type, your brand of cigarettes.
He doesn't, Liz began. Alan held up a placatory hand.
Old brand of cigarettes.
I suppose I could be crazy for letting you in on all this. There's a part of me that says I am anyway.
But as long as we've gone this far, there's no sense ignoring the forest while we look at a few trees.
You're tied in other ways as well. Castle Rock is your legal residence as well as Ludlow, being as how you pay taxes in both places. Homer Gamache was more than just an acquaintance. He did, would odd jobs be correct?
Yes, Liz said. He retired from full-time caretaking the year we bought the house. Dave Phillips and Charlie Fortin take turns doing that now, but he liked to keep his hand in.
If we assume that the hitchhiker Mrs. Arsenault observed killed Homer, and that's the assumption we're going on, a question arises. Did the hitchhiker kill him because Homer was the first person to come along who was stupid enough or drunk enough to pick him up? Or did he kill him because he was Homer Gamache, acquaintance of Thad Beaumont?
How could he know Homer would come along? Liz asked.
Because it was Homer's bowling night, and Homer was, a creature of habit. He was like an old horse, Liz. He always went back to the barn by the same route.
Your first assumption, Thad said, was that Homer didn't stop because he was drunk, but because he recognized the hitchhiker. A stranger who wanted to kill Homer wouldn't have tried the hitchhiking ploy at all. He would have figured it for a long shot, if not a totally lost cause.
Yes.
Thad, Liz said in a voice which would not quite remain steady. The police thought he stopped because he saw it was Thad, didn't they?
Yes, Thad said.
He reached across and took her hand.
They thought only someone like me, someone who knew him, would even try it that way. I suppose even the suit fits in.
What else does the well-dressed writer wear when he's planning on doing murder in the country at 1 o'clock in the morning? The good tweed, of course. The one with the brown suede patches on the elbows of the jacket. All the British mysteries insist it's absolutely de rigueur.
He looked at Alan.
It's pretty goddamned odd, isn't it? The whole thing.
Alan nodded.
It's as odd as a cod. Mrs. Arsenault thought he'd started to cross the road, or was at least on the verge of it, when Homer came poking along in his pickup. But the fact that you also knew this Clausen fellow in D.C. makes it seem more and more likely that Homer was killed because of who he was, not just because he was drunk enough to stop. So, let's talk about Frederick Clausen, Thad. Tell me about him.
Thad and Liz exchanged a glance.
I think, Thad said, that my wife might do the job more quickly and concisely than I could. She'll also swear less, I think.
Are you sure you want me to do it? Liz asked him.
Thad nodded. Liz began to speak, slowly at first, then picking up speed. Thad interrupted once or twice near the start, then settled back, content to listen. For the next half hour, he hardly spoke. Alan Pangborn took out his notebook and jotted in it, but after a few initial questions, he did not interrupt much either.
Chapter 9. The Invasion of the Creepazoid. 1.
I call him a creepazoid, Liz began. I'm sorry that he's dead, but that's what he was, just the same. I don't know if genuine creepazoids are born or made, but they rise to their own slimy station in life either way, so I guess it doesn't matter. Frederick Clausen's happened to be Washington, D.C. He went to the biggest legal snake pit on Earth to study for the bar. Thad, the kiddos are stirring. Will you give them their night bottles? And I'd like another beer, please. He got her the beer and then went out into the kitchen to warm the bottles. He wedged the kitchen door open so he could hear better, and slammed his kneecap in the process. This was something he had done so many times before that he barely noticed it. The sparrows are flying again, he thought, and rubbed at the scar on his forehead as he first filled a saucepan with warm water, then put it on the stove. Now, if I only knew what the fuck that means. We eventually got most of this story from Clausen himself, Liz went on, but his perspective was naturally a little skewed. Thad likes to say all of us are the heroes of our own lives, and according to Clausen, he was more of a Boswell than a creepazoid. But we were able to put together a more balanced version by adding stuff we got from the people at Darwin Press, which published the novels Thad wrote under Stark's name, and the stuff Rick Cowley passed along.
Who is Rick Cowley? Alan asked.
The literary agent who handled Thad under both names.
And what did Clausen, your creepazoid, want?
Money, Liz said dryly. In the kitchen, Thad took the two night bottles, only half full to help cut down on those inconvenient changes in the middle of the night, from the fridge and popped them in the pan of water. What Liz had said was right, but it was also wrong. Clausen had wanted a great deal more than money. Liz might have read his mind. Not that money was all he wanted. I'm not even sure that was the main thing. He also wanted to be known as the man who exposed George Stark's real identity.
Sort of like being the one who finally manages to unmask the incredible Spider-Man?
Exactly. Thad put a finger in the saucepan to test the water, then leaned back against the stove with his arms crossed, listening. He realized that he wanted a cigarette. For the first time in years, he wanted a cigarette again. Thad shivered. 2. Clausen was in too many right places at too many right times, Liz said. Not only was he a law student, he was a part-time bookstore clerk. Not only was he a bookstore clerk, he was an avid fan of George Stark's. And he may have been the only George Stark fan in the country who had also read Thad Beaumont's two novels. In the kitchen, Thad grinned, not without some sourness, and tested the water in the saucepan again. I think he wanted to create some sort of grand drama out of his suspicions, Liz went on. As things turned out, he had to work his fanny off to rise above the pedestrian. Once he had decided Stark was really Beaumont and vice versa, he called Darwin Press.
The Stark's book publisher.
Right. He got to Ellie Golden, the woman who edited the Stark novels. He asked the question straight out, please tell me if George Stark is really Thaddeus Beaumont. Ellie said the idea was ridiculous. Clausen then asked about the author photo on the back of the Stark novels. He said he wanted the address of the man in the picture. Ellie told him she couldn't give out the addresses of the publishing company's authors. Clausen said, I don't want Stark's address, I want the address of the man in the picture, the man posing as Stark. Ellie told him he was being ridiculous, that the man in the author photo was George Stark.
Previous to this, the publisher never came out and said it was just a pen name, Alan asked. He sounded genuinely curious. They took the position that he was a real man all along?
Oh, yes, Thad insisted.
Yes, he thought, taking the bottles out of the saucepan and testing the milk against the inside of his wrist. Thad insisted. In retrospect, Thad doesn't know just why he insisted, does not in fact have the slightest idea, but Thad did indeed insist.
He took the bottles back into the living room, avoiding a collision with the kitchen table on the way. He gave a bottle to each twin. They hoisted them solemnly, sleepily, and began to suck. Thad sat down again. He listened to Liz and told himself that the thought of a cigarette was the furthest thing from his mind. Anyway, Liz said, Clausen wanted to ask more questions. He had a whole truckload of them, I guess, but Ellie wouldn't play. She told him to call Rick Cowley and then hung up on him. Clausen then called Rick's office and got Miriam. She's Rick's ex-wife. Also his partner in the agency. The arrangement's a little odd, but they get along very well. Clausen asked her the same thing, if George Stark was really Thad Beaumont. According to Miriam, she told him yes. Also that she was Dolly Madison. "I've divorced James," she said. "Thad is divorcing Liz, and we two shall marry in the spring." And hung up. She then rushed into Rick's office and told him some guy in Washington, D.C. was prying around the edges of Thad's secret identity. After that, Clausen's calls to Cowley Associates netted him nothing but quick hang-ups. Liz took a long swallow of her beer. "He didn't give up, though. I've decided that real creepazoids never do. He just decided that Pretty Please wasn't going to work."
"And he didn't call Thad?" Alan asked.
"No, not once."
"You have an unlisted number, I suppose."
Thad made one of his few direct contributions to the story. "We're not listed in the public directories, Alan, but the phone here in Ludlow is listed in the faculty directory. It has to be. I'm a teacher, and I have advisees."
"But the guy never went directly to the horse's mouth," Alan marveled.
"He got in touch later on, by letter," Liz said. "But that's getting ahead of things. Should I go on?"
"Please," Alan said. "It's a fascinating story in its own right."
"Well," Liz said, "it took our creepazoid just 3 weeks and probably less than $500 to ferret out what he was positive about all along, that Thad and George Stark were the same man. He started with Literary Marketplace, which publishing types just call LMP. It's a digest of names, addresses, and business phone numbers for just about everyone in the field, writers, editors, publishers, agents. Using that and the People column in Publishers Weekly, he managed to isolate half a dozen Darwin Press employees who left the company between the summer of 1986 and the summer of 1987. One of them had the information and was willing to spill it. Ellie Golden's pretty sure the culprit was the girl who was the chief comptroller's secretary for 8 months in 85 and 86. Ellie called her a slut from Vassar with bad nasal habits. Alan laughed. "Thad believes that's who it was, too," Liz went on. "Because the smoking gun turned out to be photostats of royalty statements for George Stark. They came from the office of Roland Burritz."
"The Darwin Press chief comptroller," Thad said. He was watching the twins while he listened. They were lying on their backs now, sleep-suited feet pressed chummily together, bottles pointed toward the ceiling. Their eyes were glassy and distant. Soon, he knew, they would fall asleep for the night. And when they did, they would do it together. They do everything together, Thad thought. The babies are sleepy, and the sparrows are flying. He touched the scar again.
"Thad's name wasn't on the photostats," Liz said. "Royalty statements sometimes lead to checks, but they're not checks themselves, so it didn't have to appear there. You follow that, don't you?"
Alan nodded.
But the address still told him most of what he needed to know. It was Mr. George Stark, Post Office Box 1642, Brewer, Maine, 04412. That's a long way from Mississippi, where Stark was supposed to live. A look at a Maine map would have told him that the town immediately south of Brewer is Ludlow, and he knew what well-regarded, if not exactly famous, writer lived there. Thaddeus Beaumont. What a coincidence. Neither Thad nor I ever saw him in person, but he saw Thad. He knew when Darwin Press mailed out its quarterly royalty checks from the photostats he had already received. Most royalty checks go to the author's agent first, then the agent issues a new one, which reflects the original amount minus his commission. But in Stark's case, the comptroller mailed the checks directly to the Brewer post office box.
"What about the agent's commission?" Alan asked.
"Clipped off the total amount at Darwin Press and sent to Rick by separate check," Liz said. That would have been another clear signal to Clausen that George Stark wasn't what he claimed to be. Only by then, Clausen didn't need any more clues. He wanted hard proof, and set out to get it. When it was time for the royalty check to be issued, Clausen flew up here. He stayed at the Holiday Inn nights. He spent his days staking out the Brewer post office. That's exactly how he put it in the letter Thad got later on. It was a stakeout, all very film noir. It was a pretty cut-rate investigation, though. If Stark hadn't shown up to collect his check on the fourth day of his stay, Clausen would have had to fold his tent and steal back into the night. But I don't think it would have ended there. When a genuine creepazoid gets his teeth in you, he doesn't let go until he's bitten out a big chunk. Or until you knock his teeth out, Thad grunted. He saw Alan turn in his direction, eyebrows raised, and grimaced. Bad choice of words. Someone had apparently done just that to Liz's creepazoid, or something even worse. It's a moot question, anyway, Liz resumed, and Alan turned back to her. It didn't take that long. On the third day, while he was sitting on a park bench across from the post office, he saw Thad's Suburban pull into one of the 10-minute parking slots near the post office. Liz took another swallow of beer and wiped foam off her upper lip. When her hand came away, she was smiling. "Now, here's the part I like," she said. "It's just d-d-delicious, as the gay fellow in Brideshead Revisited used to say. Clausen had a camera. This little tiny camera, the sort you can cup in the palm of your hand. When you're ready to take your shot, you just spread your fingers a little to let the lens peek through, and bingo, there you are." She giggled a little, shaking her head at the image. "He said in his letter he got it from some catalog that sells spy gear. Telephone bugs, goo you swab on envelopes to turn them transparent for 10 or 15 minutes, self-destructing briefcases, stuff like that. Secret Agent X-9 Clausen reporting for duty. I bet he would have gotten a hollow tooth filled with cyanide if it was legal to sell them. He was heavily into the image. Anyhow, he got half a dozen fairly passable photos. Not arty stuff, but you could see who the subject was and what he was doing. There was a shot of Thad approaching the post office boxes in the lobby, a shot of Thad putting his key into box 1642, and one of him removing an envelope." "He sent you copies of these?" Alan asked. She had said he wanted money, and Alan guessed the lady knew what she was talking about. The setup did more than smell of blackmail. It reeked of it. "Oh, yes, and an enlargement of the last one. You can read part of the return address. The letters D-A-R-W, and you can clearly make out the Darwin Press colophon above it."
"X-9 strikes again," Alan said.
"Yes, X-9 strikes again. He got the photos developed, and then he flew back to Washington. We got his letter, with the photos included, only a few days later. The letter was really marvelous. He skated up to the edge of threat, but never once over the edge."
"He was a law student," Thad said.
"Yes," Liz agreed. "He knew just how far he could go, apparently. Thad can get you the letter, but I can paraphrase. He started by saying how much he admired both halves of what he called Thad's divided mind. He recounted what he'd found out and how he'd done it. Then he went on to his real business. He was very careful about showing us the hook, but the hook was there. He said he was an aspiring writer himself, but he didn't have much time to write. His law studies were demanding, but that was only part of it. The real problem, he said, was that he had to work in a bookstore to help pay his tuition and other bills. He said he would like to show Thad some of his work, and if Thad thought it showed promise, perhaps he might feel moved to put together an assistance package to help him along the way."
"An assistance package," Alan said, bemused. "Is that what they're calling it these days?"
Thad threw back his head and laughed.
"That's what Clausen called it, anyway. I think I can quote the last bit by heart. I know this must seem a very forward request to you on first reading," he said, "but I am sure that if you studied my work, you would quickly understand that such an arrangement might hold advantages for both of us."
Thad and I raved about it for a while, then we laughed about it, then I think we raved some more.
"Yeah," Thad said, "I don't know about the laughing, but we sure did do a lot of raving."
Finally, we got down to just plain talking. We talked almost until midnight. We both recognized Clausen's letter and his photographs for what they were, and once Thad got over being angry—
"I'm still not over being angry," Thad interjected, "and the guy's dead."
Well, once the yelling died down, Thad was almost relieved. He'd wanted to jettison Stark for quite a while, and he'd already gotten to work on a long, serious book of his own, which he's still doing. It's called The Golden Dog. I've read the first 200 pages, and it's lovely. Much better than the last couple of things he churned out as George Stark.
So Thad decided...
We decided, Thad said.
Okay, we decided that Clawson was a blessing in disguise, a way to hurry along what was already coming. Thad's only fear was that Rick Cowley wouldn't like the idea much because George Stark was earning more for the agency than Thad, by far. But he was a real honey about it. In fact, he said it might just generate some publicity that would help in a number of areas. Stark's backlist, Thad's own backlist,
all two books of it, Thad put in with a smile,
and the new book when it finally comes out.
Pardon me, what's a backlist? Alan asked. Grinning now, Thad said, the old books they no longer put in the fancy dump bins at the front of the chain bookstores. So you went public?
Yes, Liz said. First to the AP here in Maine and to Publishers Weekly, but the story popped up on the National Wire. Stark was a best-selling writer, after all, and the fact that he never really existed at all made for interesting filler on the back pages. And then People magazine got in touch. We got one more squealing, angry letter from Frederick Clawson telling us how mean and nasty and thankless we were. He seemed to think we had no right to take him out of things the way we had, because he had done all the work and all Thad had done was to write a few books. After that, he signed off.
And now he's signed off for good, Thad said. No, Alan said. Someone signed off for him. And that's a big difference. Another silence fell among them. It was short, but very, very heavy.
3.
Alan thought for several minutes. Thad and Liz led him. At last he looked up and said, okay, why? Why would anyone resort to murder over this, especially after the secret had already come out? Thad shook his head. If it has to do with me or the books I wrote as George Stark, I don't know who or why.
And over a pen name? Alan asked in a musing voice. I mean, no offense intended, Thad, but it wasn't exactly a classified document or a big military secret.
No offense taken, Thad said. In fact, I couldn't agree more.
Stark had a lot of fans, Liz said. Some of them were angry that Thad wasn't going to write any more novels as Stark. People got some letters after the article, and Thad's gotten a bunch. One lady went so far as to suggest that Alexis Machine should come out of retirement and cook Thad's goose.
Who's Alexis Machine? Alan had produced the notebook again. Thad grinned.
Soft, soft, my good inspector. Machine's just a character in two of the novels George wrote. The first and the last.
A fiction by a fiction, Alan said, putting the notebook back.
Great.
Thad, meanwhile, looked mildly startled.
A fiction by a fiction, he said.
That's not bad, not bad at all.
My point was this, Liz said. Maybe Clawson had a friend, always assuming creepazoids have friends, who was a rabid Stark fan. Maybe he knew Clawson was really responsible for blowing the story wide open and got so mad because there wouldn't be any more Stark novels that he...
She sighed, looked down at her beer bottle for a moment, then raised her head again.
That's actually pretty lame, isn't it?
I'm afraid so, Alan said kindly, then looked at Thad.
You ought to be down on your knees thanking God for your alibi now, even if you weren't before. You do realize this makes you look even tastier as a suspect, don't you?
I suppose in a way it does, Thad agreed. Thaddeus Beaumont has written two books hardly anybody has read. The second, published 11 years ago, didn't even review very well. The infinitesimal advances he got didn't earn out. It'll be a wonder if he can even get published again, with the business being what it is. Stark, on the other hand, makes money by the fistful. They're discreet fistfuls, but the books still earn 4 times what I make teaching each year. This guy Clawson comes along with his carefully worded blackmail threat. I refuse to cave in, but my only option is to go public with the story myself. Not long after, Clawson is killed. It looks like a great motive, but it's really not. Killing a would-be blackmailer after you've already told the secret yourself would be dumb.
Yes, but there's always revenge.
I suppose, until you look at the rest of it.
What Liz told you is perfectly true. Stark was just about ready for the scrap heap anyway. There might have been one more book, but only one. And one of the reasons Rick Cowley was such a honey, as Liz put it, was because he knew it. And he was right about the publicity.
The People article, silly as it was, has done wonders for sales. Rick tells me Riding to Babylon has a shot at going back on the bestseller list, and sales are up on all Stark novels. Dutton's even planning to bring The Sudden Dancers and Purple Haze back into print. You look at it that way, Clausen did me a favor.
So, where does that leave us? Alan asked.
I'll be damned if I know, Thad replied.
Into the silence that followed, Liz said in a soft voice, It's a crocodile hunter. I was thinking about them just this morning. It's a crocodile hunter, and he's just as crazy as a loon.
Crocodile hunter? Alan turned to her. Liz explained about Thad's see the living crocodiles syndrome.
It could have been a crazy fan, she said. It's not that lame, not when you think about the fellow who shot John Lennon and the one who tried to kill Ronald Reagan to impress Jodie Foster. They are out there. And if Clausen could find out about Thad, someone else could have found out about Clausen.
But why would a guy like that try to implicate me if he loves my stuff so much? Thad asked.
Because he doesn't, Liz said vehemently. Stark's the man the crocodile hunter loves. He probably hates you almost as much as he hated, Clausen. You said you weren't sorry Stark was dead. That could be reason enough right there.
I still don't buy it, Alan said. The fingerprints...
You say prints have never been copied or planted, Alan, but since they were in both places, there must be a way. It's the only thing that fits.
Thad heard himself say, No, you're wrong, Liz. If there is such a guy, he doesn't just love Stark.
He looked down at his arms and saw they were covered with goosebumps.
No? Alan asked.
Thad looked up at them both.
Have you thought that the man who killed Homer Gamache and Frederick Clausen might think he is George Stark?
4. On the steps, Alan said, I'll keep you in touch, Thad. In one hand, he held photocopies, made on the machine in Thad's office, of Frederick Clausen's two letters. Thad thought privately that Alan's willingness to accept photocopies, at least for the present, rather than insisting on taking the originals into evidence, was the clearest sign of all that he had given over most of his suspicions.
And be back to arrest me if you find the loophole in my alibi? Thad asked, smiling.
I don't think that's going to happen. The only thing I'd ask is that you keep me in touch as well.
If something comes up, you mean?
Yes, that's what I mean.
I'm sorry we couldn't be more helpful, Liz told him.
Alan grinned.
You've helped me a lot. I couldn't decide whether to hang on another day, which would mean another night in a cinderblock Ramada Inn room, or drive back to Castle Rock. Thanks to what you've told me, I'm opting for the drive.
Starting now. It'll be good to get back. Just lately, my wife Annie's been a little under the weather.
Nothing serious, I hope, Liz said.
Migraine, Alan said briefly. He started down the walk, then turned back.
There is one other thing.
Thad rolled his eyes at Liz.
Here it comes, he said. It's the old Columbo crumpled raincoat zinger.
Nothing like that, Alan said. But the Washington PD is holding back one piece of physical evidence in the Clausen killing. It's common practice, helps to weed out the crazies who like to confess to crimes they didn't commit.
Something was written on the wall of Clausen's apartment.
Alan paused and then added almost apologetically, It was written in the victim's blood. If I tell you what it was, will you give me your word you'll keep it under your hats? They nodded. The phrase was, The sparrows are flying again. Does that mean anything to either of you?
No, Liz said.
No, Thad said in a neutral voice after a momentary hesitation. Alan's gaze stayed on Thad's face for a moment.
You are quite sure?
Quite sure. Alan sighed.
I doubted if it would, but it seemed like a shot worth taking.
There are so many other weird connections, I thought there just might be one more.
Good night, Thad, Liz.
Remember to get in touch if anything occurs.
We will, Liz said.
Count on it, Thad agreed. A moment later, they were both inside again, with the door closed against Alan Pangborn, and the dark through which he would make his long trip home. Chapter 10 Later that night. 1. They carried the sleeping twins upstairs, then began to get ready for bed themselves. Thad undressed to his shorts and undershirt, his form of pajamas, and went into the bathroom. He was brushing his teeth when the shakes hit. He dropped the toothbrush, spat a mouthful of white foam into the basin, and then lurched over to the toilet on legs with no more feeling in them than a pair of wooden stilts. He retched once, a miserable dry sound, but nothing came up. His stomach began to settle again, at least on a trial basis. When he turned around, Liz was standing in the doorway, wearing a blue nylon nightie that stopped several inches north of the knee. She was looking at him levelly. "You're keeping secrets, Thad. That's no good. It never was." He sighed harshly and held his hands out in front of him with the fingers splayed. They were still trembling. "How long have you known?" "There's been something offbeat about you ever since the sheriff came back tonight. And when he asked that last question, about the thing written on Clawson's wall, you might as well have had a neon sign on your forehead."
"Pangborn didn't see any neon."
"Sheriff Pangborn doesn't know you as well as I do, but if you didn't see him do a double take there at the end, you weren't looking. Even he saw something wasn't quite kosher. It was the way he looked at you." Her mouth drew down slightly. It emphasized the old lines in her face, the ones he had first seen after the accident in Boston and the miscarriage, the ones which had deepened as she watched him struggle harder and harder to bring water from a well which seemed to have gone dry. It was around then that his drinking had begun to waver out of control. All these things, Liz's accident, the miscarriage, the critical and financial failure of Purple Haze following the wild success of Machine's Way under the Stark name, the sudden binge drinking, had combined to bring on a deep depressive state. He had recognized it as a selfish, inward-turning frame of mind, but recognition hadn't helped. Finally, he had washed a handful of sleeping pills down his throat with half a bottle of Jack Daniels. It had been an unenthusiastic suicide attempt, but a suicide attempt it had been. All of these things had taken place in a period of 3 years. It had seemed much longer at the time. At the time, it had seemed forever. And of course, little or none of it had made it into the pages of People magazine. Now he saw Liz looking at him the way she had looked at him then. He hated it. The worry was bad. The mistrust was worse. He thought outright hate would have been easier to bear than that odd, wary look. "I hate it when you lie to me," she said simply.
"I didn't lie, Liz, for God's sake."
"Sometimes people lie just by being quiet."
"I was going to tell you anyway," he said.
"I was only trying to find my way to it."
But was that true? Was it really? He didn't know. It was weird shit, crazy shit, but that wasn't the reason he might have lied by silence.
He had felt the urge to be silent the way a man who has observed blood in his stool or felt a lump in his groin might feel the urge to be silent. Silence in such cases is irrational. But fear is also irrational. And there was something else. He was a writer, an imaginer. He had never met one, including himself, who had more than the vaguest idea of why he or she did anything. He sometimes believed that the compulsion to make fiction was no more than a bulwark against confusion, maybe even insanity. It was a desperate imposition of order by people able to find that precious stuff only in their minds, never in their hearts. Inside him, a voice whispered for the first time, "Who are you when you write, Thad? Who are you then?" And for that voice, he had no answer. "Well?" Liz asked. Her tone was sharp, teetering on the edge of anger. He looked up out of his own thoughts, startled. "Pardon? Have you found your way to it, whatever it may be?" "Look," he said, "I don't understand why you sound so pissed, Liz." "Because I'm scared," she cried angrily. But he saw tears in the corners of her eyes now. "Because you held out on the sheriff, and I still wonder if you won't hold out on me. If I hadn't seen that expression on your face..."
"Oh?"
Now he began to feel angry himself. "And what expression was it? What did it look like to you?" "You looked guilty," she snapped. "You looked the way you used to look when you were telling people you'd stopped drinking and you hadn't. When..." She stopped then. He did not know what she saw in his face. Wasn't sure he wanted to know, but it wiped away her anger. A stricken look replaced it.
I'm sorry, that wasn't fair.
Why not? He said dully. It was true. For a while. He went back into the bathroom and used the mouthwash to rinse away the last of the toothpaste. It was non-alcoholic mouthwash, like the cough medicine, and the ersatz vanilla in the kitchen cupboard. He had not taken a drink since completing the last Stark novel. Her hand touched his shoulder lightly.
Thad, we're being angry. That hurts us both, and it won't help whatever is wrong. You said there might be a man out there, a psychotic who thinks he is George Stark. He's killed two people we know. One of them was partly responsible for blowing the Stark pseudonym. It must have occurred to you that you could be high on that man's enemies list. But in spite of that, you held something back. What was that phrase?
The sparrows are flying again, Thad said.
He looked at his face in the harsh white light thrown by the fluorescence over the bathroom mirror. Same old face. A little shadowy under the eyes, maybe, but it was still the same old face.
He was glad. It was no movie star's mug, but it was his.
Yes, that meant something to you. What was it?
He turned off the bathroom light and put his arm over her shoulders. They walked to the bed and lay down on it.
When I was 11 years old, he said, I had an operation. It was to remove a small tumor from the frontal lobe, I think it was the frontal lobe, of my brain.
You knew about that?
Yes. She was looking at him, puzzled.
I told you I had bad headaches before that tumor was diagnosed, right?
Right.
He began to stroke her thigh absently. She had lovely long legs, and the nightie was really very short.
What about the sounds?
Sounds? She looked puzzled. I didn't think so. But you see, it never seemed very important. All that happened such a long time ago. People with brain tumors often have headaches, sometimes they have seizures, and sometimes they have both. Quite often these symptoms have their own symptoms. They're called sensory precursors. The most common ones are smells, pencil shavings, freshly cut onions, moldy fruit. My sensory precursor was auditory. It was birds. He looked at her levelly, their noses almost touching. He could feel a stray strand of her hair tickling against his forehead. Sparrows, to be exact. He sat up, not wanting to look at her expression of sudden shock. He took her hand. Come on.
Thad, where?
The study, he said. I want to show you something. 2. Thad's study was dominated by a huge oak desk. It was neither fashionably antique nor fashionably modern. It was just an extremely large, extremely serviceable hunk of wood. It stood like a dinosaur under three hanging glass globes. The combined light they threw upon the work surface was just short of fierce. Very little of the desk's surface was visible. Manuscripts, piles of correspondence, books, and galley proofs which had been sent to him were stacked everywhere and anywhere. On the white wall beyond the desk was a poster depicting Thad's favorite structure in the whole world. The Flatiron Building in New York. Its improbable wedge shape never failed to delight him. Beside the typewriter was the manuscript of his new novel, The Golden Dog. On top of the typewriter was that day's output, 6 pages. It was his usual number, when he was working as himself, that was. As Stark, he usually did 8, and sometimes 10. This is what I was fooling with before Pangborn showed up, he said, picking up the little stack of pages on top of the typewriter and handing them to her. Then the sound came, the sound of the sparrows. For the second time today, only this time it was much more intense. You see what's written across that top sheet? She looked for a long time, and he could see only her hair and the top of her head. When she looked back at him, all the color had dropped out of her face. Her lips were pressed together in a narrow gray line.
It's the same, she whispered. It's the very same. Oh, Thad, what is this? What?
She swayed, and he moved forward, afraid for a moment she was actually going to faint.
He grasped her shoulders, his foot tangled in the X-shaped foot of his office chair, and he almost spilled them both onto his desk. Are you all right?
No,
she said in a thin voice.
Are you?
Not exactly, he said. I'm sorry. Same old clumsy Beaumont. As a knight in shining armor, I make a hell of a good doorstop.
You wrote this before Pangborn ever showed up, she said.
She seemed to find this impossible to fully grasp.
Before?
That's right.
What does it mean?
She was looking at him with frantic intensity, the pupils of her eyes large and dark in spite of the bright light.
I don't know, he said.
I thought you might have an idea. She shook her head and put the pages back on his desk. Then she rubbed her hand against the short nylon skirt of her nightie, as if she had touched something nasty. Thad didn't believe she was aware of what she was doing, and he didn't tell her.
Now do you understand why I held it back? He asked.
Yes, I think so.
What would he have said?
Our practical sheriff from Maine's smallest county, who puts his faith in computer printouts from ASR&I and eyewitness testimony. Our sheriff who found it more plausible that I might be hiding a twin brother than that someone has somehow discovered how to duplicate fingerprints. What would he have said to this?
I don't know.
She was struggling to bring herself back, to haul herself out of the shockwave. He had seen her do it before, but that did not lessen his admiration for her.
I don't know what he would have said, Thad.
Me either. I think at the very worst he might assume some foreknowledge of the crime. It's probably more likely he'd believe I ran up here and wrote that after he left tonight.
Why would you do a thing like that? Why?
I think insanity would be the first assumption, Thad said dryly. I think a cop like Pangborn would be a lot more likely to believe insanity than to accept an occurrence which seems to have no explanation outside the paranormal. But if you think I'm wrong to hold this back until I have a chance to make something of it myself, and I might be, say so. We can call the Castle Rock Sheriff's Office and leave a message for him. She shook her head.
I don't know. I've heard, on some talk show or other, I guess, about psychic links.
Do you believe in them?
I never had any reason to think much about the idea one way or the other, she said. Now I guess I do.
She reached over and picked up the sheet with the words scrawled on it.
You wrote it with one of George's pencils, she said.
It was the closest thing to hand, that's all, he said testily. He thought briefly of the scripto pen and then shut it out of his mind.
And they aren't George's pencils and never were, they're mine. I'm getting goddamn tired of referring to him as a separate person. It's lost any marginal cuteness it might once have had.
Yet you used one of his phrases today, too. Lie me an alibi. I never heard you use it before outside of a book. Was that just a coincidence?
He started to tell her that it was. Of course it was. And stopped.
It probably was, but in light of what he had written on that sheet of paper, how could he know for sure?
I don't know.
Were you in a trance, Thad? Were you in a trance when you wrote this?
Slowly, reluctantly, he replied, Yes, I think I was.
Is this all that happened? Or was there more?
I can't remember, he said, and then added even more reluctantly, I think I might have said something, but I really can't remember.
She looked at him for a long time and said, Let's go to bed.
Do you think we'll sleep, Liz?
She laughed forlornly. 3. But 20 minutes later, he was actually drifting away when Liz's voice brought him back.
You have to go to the doctor, she said, on Monday.
There are no headaches this time, he protested. Just the bird sounds, and that weird thing I wrote.
He paused, then added hopefully, You don't suppose it could just be a coincidence?
I don't know what it is, Liz said, but I've got to tell you, Thad, coincidence is very low on my list.
For some reason, this struck them both as funny, and they lay in bed, giggling as softly as they could so as not to wake the babies, and holding each other. It was all right between them again, anyway. There was not much Thad felt he could be sure of just now, but that was one thing. It was all right. The storm had passed. The sorry old bones had been buried again, at least for the time being.
"I'll make the appointment," she said when their giggles had dried up.
"No," he said, "I'll do it."
"And you won't indulge in any creative forgetting?"
"No, I'll do it first thing Monday. Honest John."
"All right, then," she sighed. "It'll be a goddamn miracle if I get any sleep."
But 5 minutes later, she was breathing softly and regularly. And not 5 minutes after that, Thad was asleep himself. 4. And dreamed the dream again. It was the same, or seemed so anyway, right up until the very end. Stark took him through the deserted house, always remaining behind him, telling Thad he was mistaken when Thad insisted in a trembling, distraught voice that this was his own house. "You are quite wrong," Stark said from behind his right shoulder. Or was it the left? And did it matter? "The owner of this house," he told Thad again, "was dead. The owner of this house was in that fabled place where all rail service terminated, that place which everyone down here, wherever that was, called Ennsville." Everything the same, until they got to the back hall, where Liz was no longer alone. Frederick Clausen had joined her. He was naked except for an absurd leather coat, and he was just as dead as Liz. From over his shoulder, Stark said reflectively, "Down here, that's what happens to squealers. They get turned into fool's stuffing. Now he's taken care of. I'm going to take care of all of them, one by one. Just make sure I don't have to take care of you. The sparrows are flying again, Thad. Remember that. The sparrows are flying." And then, outside the house, Thad heard them. Not just thousands of them, but millions, perhaps billions. And the day turned dark as the gigantic flock of birds first began to cross the sun and then blotted it out entirely. "I can't see," he screamed, and from behind him, George Stark whispered, "They're flying again, old hoss. Don't forget, and don't get in my way." He woke up, trembling and cold all over, and this time sleep was a long time coming. He lay in the dark, thinking how absurd it was, the idea the dream had brought with it. Perhaps it had the first time, too, but it had been so much clearer this time. How totally absurd. The fact that he had always visualized Stark and Alexis Machine as looking alike, and why not, since in a very real sense both had been born at the same time with Machine's way, both tall and broad-shouldered, men who looked not as if they had grown, but as if they had somehow been built out of solid blocks of material, and both blonde. That fact didn't change the absurdity. Pen names did not come to life and murder people. He would tell Liz at breakfast, and they would laugh over it. Well, maybe they wouldn't actually laugh, considering the circumstances, but they would share a rueful grin. "I will call it my William Wilson complex," he thought, drifting back into sleep again. But when the morning came, the dream did not seem worth talking about, not on top of everything else. So he didn't. But as the day passed, he found his mind returning to it again and again, considering it like a dark jewel. Chapter 11. Ennsville. 1. Early Monday morning, before Liz could bug him about it, he made an appointment with Dr. Hume. The removal of the tumor in 1960 was a part of his medical records. He told Hume that he had recently had two recurrences of the bird sounds which had presaged his headaches during the months leading up to the diagnosis and the excision. Dr. Hume wanted to know if the headaches themselves had returned. Thad told him they had not. He said nothing about the trance state, or what he had written while in that state, or what had been found written on the apartment wall of a murder victim in Washington, D.C. It already seemed as distant as last night's dream. In fact, he found himself trying to poo-poo the whole thing. Dr. Hume, however, took it seriously, very seriously. He ordered Thad to go to the Eastern Maine Medical Center that afternoon. He wanted both a cranial X-ray series and a computerized axial tomography, a CAT scan. Thad went. He sat for the pictures and then put his head inside a machine which looked like an industrial clothes dryer. It clashed and ratcheted for 15 minutes, and then he was released from captivity. for the time being, anyway. He telephoned Liz, told her they could expect results around the end of the week, and said he was going up to his office at the university for a little while. "Have you thought any more about calling Sheriff Pangborn?" she asked. "Let's wait for the test results," he said. "Once we see what we've got, maybe we can decide." 2. He was in his office, clearing a semester's worth of dead wood out of his desk and off his shelves, when the birds began to cry inside his head again. There were a few isolated twitters. These were joined by others, and they quickly became a deafening chorus. White sky. He saw a white sky broken by the silhouettes of houses and telephone poles. And everywhere there were sparrows. They lined every roof, crowded every pole, waiting only for the command of the group mind. Then they would explode skyward with a sound like thousands of sheets flapping in a brisk wind. Thad staggered blindly toward his desk, groped for his chair, found it, collapsed into it. Sparrows. Sparrows in the white sky of late spring. The sound filled his head, a jumbled cacophony, and when he drew a sheet of paper toward him and began to write, he was not aware of what he was doing. His head lolled back on his neck, his eyes stared sightlessly at the ceiling. The pen flew back and forth and up and down, seeming to do so of its own accord. In his head, all the birds took wing in a dark cloud that blotted out the white sky of March in the Ridgeway section of Bergen Field, New Jersey. 3. He came back to himself less than 5 minutes after the first isolated cries had begun to sound in his mind. He was sweating heavily, and his left wrist throbbed, but there was no headache. He looked down, saw the paper on his desk. It was the back of an order form for complimentary American lit textbooks, and stared stupidly at what was written there. Sis, sis, cats, fools now, flying again, sissy, phone, mirror, forever, fools, sis, Ennsville, sis, terminate, the cats, phone, sissy, the cuts, razor, sis, down here, sis, sparrows, mirror, sis, razor, and forever, sissy now, meerkats, stuff, sissy, sparrow. It means nothing, he whispered. He was rubbing his temples with the tips of his fingers, waiting for the headache to start, or for the scrawled words on the paper to connect and make some sense. He did not want either of those things to happen, and neither of them did. The words were just words, repeated over and over. Some were obviously culled from his dream of Stark. The others were so much unconnected gibberish. And his head felt just fine. I'm not going to tell Liz this time, he thought. Be damned if I will. And not just because I'm scared either, although I am. It's perfectly simple. Not all secrets are bad secrets. Some are good secrets. Some are necessary secrets. And this one is both of those. He didn't know if that was really true or not, but he discovered something which was tremendously liberating. He didn't care. He was very tired of thinking and still not knowing. He was also tired of being frightened, like a man who has entered a cave on a lark and now begins to suspect he is lost. Stop thinking about it, then. That's the solution. He suspected that was true. He did not know if he could do it or not, but he intended to give it the old college try. Very slowly he reached out, took the order form in both hands, and began to tear it into strips. The stew of squirming words written on it began to disappear. He turned the strips lengthwise, tore them across again, and tossed the pieces in the wastebasket, where they rested like confetti on top of all the other crap he had dumped in there. He sat staring at the pieces for almost 2 minutes, half expecting them to fly back together and then return to his desk, like the images in a reel of movie film which is run backward. At last he picked up the wastebasket and took it down the hall to a stainless steel panel set into the wall next to the elevator. The sign beneath read, Incinerator. He opened the panel and dumped his trash down the black chute. There, he said into the odd summer silence of the English math building. All gone. Down here we call that fool's stuffing. Up here we call it horseshit, he muttered, and walked back down to his office with the empty wastebasket in his hand. It was gone, down the chute into oblivion.
and until his test results came back from the hospital, or until there was another blackout or trance or fugue or whatever the hell it was, he intended to say nothing. Nothing at all. More than likely, the words written on that sheet of paper had been wholly grown in his own mind, like the dream of Stark and the empty house, and had nothing at all to do with either the murder of Homer Gamache or that of Frederick Clausen.
Down here in Ennsville, where all rail service terminates.
It means nothing at all, Thad said in a flat, emphatic voice. But when he left the university that day, he was almost fleeing.